3014. Good morning. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. Sorry we're running a little late. I had a couple of meetings with representatives, and let's say our conversations went longer than anticipated. With that, we'll have a segue. We're going to open up House Bill 3014, and we're going to have Representative Krieger come forward. But, Anna, give us an overview, please.
Certainly, Chair Prezonsky and members of the committee. House Bill 3014 deals with grandparents and dependency proceedings. Currently, grandparents of a child in a dependency proceeding are entitled to notice of the hearing regarding the grandchild. And while they're not parties to the dependency proceeding, they do have an opportunity to be heard and can request court visitation, or they can ask the court for visitation or contact with the child. A grandparent is defined as the legal parent of a child's legal parent. The same statute specifies that legal parent means a parent whose rights have not been terminated. As a result, grandparents of a child may be excluded from the notice and visitation provisions if the parental rights of the parent have been terminated. House Bill 3014 changes that definition of grandparent so as to include the legal parents of a child's parents, even if the parental rights of the parent have been terminated.
All right.
Yes, it is.
It is, and you did very well. Representative Krieger.
Yeah, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. Staff has pretty well told you what I was going to tell you. But in 2013, we did pass a grandparents' rights bill. I can't remember the number now. Livingston, Judge Livingston, helped us write that it would be not in conflict with any of the statutes and really allowed the grandparents to have a voice to be heard and make a request for some type of visitation or contact, and that's what the bill did. What we didn't realize at the time was that the definition of a grandparent changes when the parents' legal rights are terminated. You are no longer a grandparent. So this simply changes the statute. If you look at the bill on line 41, it just simply says that the legal parents have been terminated under ORF 419B-500, but that makes sure that these parents, grandparents, still are grandparents for the purposes of visitation.
All right. Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Krieger. And you and I have had a lot of conversations about this in the past. So when we talked about this last session, it was really important that this distinction took place. So what happens when an adoption is taking place? For instance, when we adopted our children, there was a period of time before it was finalized where they were placed with us, but they were basically a ward of the court. Why should the grandparents of the birth parents have rights to visit when you adopt a child and the law says that that child is as if that child was born to you?
Those rights, I believe, under the bill don't confer over to when the child is actually adopted. It's while they're in the control of the Department of Human Resources, the state. And here again, during that period of time, the judge has the full discretion to make determination, is it in the best interest of the child? And some of the testimony we heard then and the dependency work groups that we've had is that oftentimes the children that come out of these different types of homes where there's problems, the relationship between grandparents is kind of the foundation of that family, and there's no sense in destroying that foundation. Right now, if someone is an adoptive parent, this bill does not require them to allow visitation.
And just follow up?
Yes.
I'm speaking of that period of time between when that initial placement is made, and it can take 6 months to a year for that adoption to be finalized. So that parent isn't technically the adoptive parent. The child is a ward of the agency or of the state in that period. So I'm concerned about extending this right when there has been a decision to complete a different family structure where this child will be a member of a different family.
Well, this bill doesn't extend it. The bill did last time. This bill only changes the definition of a parent for the rights of those visitations. The other bill is one that you I don't know if you objected to it or not, but that was the one that gave the grandparents an opportunity to be heard, and the judge then makes the final decision if it's in the best interest of the child for that visitation to continue.
And I guess why it seems like this would make that extension is in the other one, once the parental rights were terminated, because I had actually asked that question last time, then that right disappears. So in an adoption proceeding, those parental rights are going to be surrendered and terminated. Under this bill, even though those parental rights are surrendered or terminated, these other people would then still have a right to visitation with the child, even though another family has entered the proceedings to start adopting that child in a different family. I guess I don't understand why in that circumstance, if the relationship with the family has been legally severed and the child is entering into a new legal relationship, why the right to the grandparents would supersede the right. It just seems like this would be very disruptive of an adoption process and the permanency of that child and the forming of the new bonds with their real family.
It would be up to the judge to make that determination that you're asserting. If he felt that that continued visitation or contact was detrimental to the children or the family that was going to have those children as an adoptive, I would assume he wouldn't allow it then.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Wayne, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on 3014? I don't see anyone come forward. I'm going to close the public hearing. And we're going to hold off on this until we get out all of our members so we can have the vote. I'm assuming you're okay.
Yes,
Bill.
Yes.
So with that, we're going to go ahead and go up to the top and start with 2339. So I'll open up the public hearing on House Bill 2339.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2339 comes to you from the Judicial Department. Oregon's Constitution grants the victims of crimes a right to be present at critical stages of the criminal prosecution and to be heard at pretrial release hearings and sentencing. Courts must appoint interpreters for non-English speaking parties or witnesses, but they do not have a requirement to appoint an interpreter for a victim who is there in court. House Bill 2339 extends that requirement, the requirement that courts appoint an interpreter, to include victims when those victims are seeking to exercise their constitutional rights. It has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Wonderful. Josh, you're on. And while Josh is coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2339? Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nasby, and I'm with the Office of the State Court Administrator in the Oregon Judicial Department. House Bill 2339 amends the interpreter statutes, and the bill requires the court to appoint an interpreter for a victim of crime who seeks to exercise in open court a right granted by Article 1, Section 42 or 43 of the Oregon Constitution. These are the victims' rights provisions of the Constitution, and they provide victims with a number of rights, the right to notice of certain hearings, the right to be heard at certain stages of the proceedings. And for present purposes, the most important of these rights is the right to be present at any critical stage of the proceeding held in open court when the defendant will be present. And under the statutes, the interpreter statutes, the court has clear authority to appoint an interpreter when a victim is testifying as a witness. And the interpreter statutes are also flexible enough to allow the court to appoint an interpreter when a victim engages in a colloquy with the court. So if you imagine a victim impact statement at a sentencing hearing, the court has the authority in that circumstance today to appoint an interpreter. What the bill does is it identifies a gap in the statutes where victim wants to exercise the right to be present, and it requires the court to appoint an interpreter whenever it's necessary to interpret the proceedings. And in doing so, the bill provides all victims of crime, whether non-English speaking or not, whether hearing impaired or not, with the opportunity to meaningfully exercise the right to be present. While that's the primary focus of the bill, there's one other issue I just want to sort of bring to your attention that is unrelated to victims of crime. So there are two interpreter statutes. There's one for non-English speaking persons, and there's one for persons with a hearing or speaking impairment. And under the former statute, current language suggests that the court has the authority to charge certain parties for the costs related to the interpreter. That's not something we do today. It's inconsistent with OJD policy, but I think more importantly, it's inconsistent with federal civil rights law. So while we're in here, providing victims with an interpreter in critical stages of the proceedings, we're also cleaning up this fee language. And so appreciate your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. question for me is, understanding you said that we have two separate different statutes, is there a reason to maintain two separate, or should would it be better and since more user-friendly to put it all in one?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, that's certainly something you could consider. I think as long as you're sort of amending them both at the same time, no harm, no foul, but a bigger picture, I can't say you're wrong.
Or that I'm right. I'm just wondering if it would make it more simple if we would actually, if we're in there cleaning it up, and I appreciate you catching the first one as to not charging for things that are protected with civil rights protections. But I'm just wondering if it would be, I'm not even sure where they're at in the statutes. Are they back to back?
I think it's 445, 275, and 285, so they're in the same series.
All right. I'm fine with that. All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. And we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2339. And why don't you just stay right where you're at, Josh, and go ahead and open up a work session on 2339.
Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2339 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2339 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Gelser, will you carry this one?
Sure.
And we'll close the work session on 2339. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2340A. Shauna?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2340A seeks to protect personal information in court documents by restricting identifying information such as Social Security numbers, taxpayer identification numbers, and driver license numbers to only the last four digits on certain publicly available documents. Additionally, if the restitution or compensatory fine is ordered, only the name of the person may be included, not the address. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no amendments.
All right. Thank you. Josh.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Josh Nasby. I'm with the Office of the State Court Administrator in the Oregon Judicial Department. House Bill 2340 is an e-court bill and is designed to protect the personal information of court users. And as many of you know, we're in the middle of a multi-year transition from a paper-based court system using what I think is a COBOL-based case management system to a more modern e-court product. And today we've converted 16 counties.
That's like a flash from the past.
Yeah. it's a green screen. It's fantastic.
Right after Fortran 4 with the push cards, if I'm not mistaken.
So we're in the midst of this multi-year transition, and to date we've converted 16 counties to the new system. And because it's sort of the higher volume counties, we're way past halfway. We're something like 60% of all cases filed today are filed in the e-court system. And there are a number of sort of exciting features in e-court if you're into these kinds of things. You can electronically file documents with the court. You can serve the other party. And I think for purposes of this bill, the most important feature is the ability to access documents remotely. And while there are clear benefits to courts, to litigants, to lawyers, and even to the public, to the ability to sort of click on documents and view them online, there's also a potential that information in those documents can be misused. And so for that reason, House Bill 2340 makes three changes to the law, cleans up documents, and allows us to obtain and maintain this information in places other than specific legally significant court documents. Real briefly, the first involves taxpayer identification numbers. These are effectively a business's Social Security number. And the bill requires that these numbers be truncated in civil judgments containing a money award, and then there's a corresponding document called a lien record abstract. In both of those documents, the bill truncates, that is, requires that only the last four digits of the taxpayer identification number be included. The second change involves Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers in paternity proceedings. And currently, the statutes require that these numbers be included in the judgments and orders in their entirety, but the law also gives the Chief Justice authority to adopt rules to modify that result. So in the real world, this particular change won't have an impact, but we want to go ahead and clean up the statutes and say Social Security numbers should be truncated in these documents. And the third and final change involves criminal judgments in which a victim of crime is owed restitution or a compensatory fine. As you may know, the defendant doesn't mail the victim a check directly. They mail the check to the court, and the court disperses the payments. And there's just just simply no reason for us to, we don't need the victim's address in the judgment. And so when these judgments become sort of more widely available, we think it's appropriate to protect the victim's address. So I think it's a pretty straightforward bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions? Josh, you did a great job. Thank you. Let me just see if anyone else wants to testify today on House Bill 2340A.
Thank you.
Not seeing. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing, open the work session on 2340A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2340A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2340A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 2340A. We'll close the work session on 2340A. We're now going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2349A.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2349A deals with professional fiduciaries. A professional fiduciary is a person who serves or has been nominated as a fiduciary for three or more protection persons who are not related to the fiduciary. House Bill 2349 extends the information that a professional fiduciary must disclose to a court in a petition for appointment and requires disclosure of investment credentials and licensing, a description of the fee arrangement and compensation paid to other financial professionals in the annual report to the court, and it ties the professional fiduciary's actions to the Uniform Prudent Investor Act. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, no amendments today.
All right, thank you. So Tim and Stuart, y'all are here. Thank you very much. Who's going to lead off?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. First of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, for hearing this bill. I will start off by saying it did pass the House 60-0 without any objections. I discovered the other day in one of your other Senate committees that doesn't always necessarily mean anything, but I would like to put that on the record. This bill, as your counsel described, does deal with professional fiduciaries. I have here to my right Stuart Allen, who is here representing the Trust Committee for the Oregon Bankers Association. He has a highly regulated trust company in Portland, Stuart Allen Trust Company. He is the policy expert and could hopefully answer any questions that the committee might have. But I would just briefly say this bill, you passed a bill last session on this issue, and we see some minor tweaks and some very small expansion to the bill, and I'd be happy to let Mr. Allen describe what those are.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stuart Allen. I'm representing the Oregon Bankers Trust Committee. And the bill basically is like Tim said, some minor changes to the Private Fiduciary Act. In Oregon, there are private fiduciaries and then banks and trust companies that serve as trustee and fiduciary for a lot of folks. And a lot of them very vulnerable Oregonians. They're, as banks and trust companies, we are required to disclose our fees, and private fiduciaries disclose their fees, but there is no current law requiring them to investigate and determine what the investment fees are related to the assets that they manage, and this requires them to do the investigation. It also gives them a little bit of a tool in determining those fees. Sometimes they request from brokers and others what their fees are, and sometimes they're not necessarily as forthcoming as they should be, some of the investment folks. So this will give them a little bit of a tool in determining what those fees are. It also requires them to put down that they are going to act as according to the private prudent investor rule. They don't necessarily know or aware of that of the requirement to do that. It also requires the fees to be determined and put forth on the annual accounting at the end of the year. So I think it's a good balance. We've talked to the Oregon State Bar about this. We've talked to the elder law section. I've spoken personally with judges, and I'm also a member of the estate planning section of the bar. I'm also a lawyer. So a lot of the folks feel like this is a good bill, a good balance, and it requires all the right things going forward.
All right. Did you say almost a lawyer?
I'm currently a member of the bar.
Okay. I was going to say that's what everyone here is.
But I don't go to court very often. So.
All right. Stuart, thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions?
Senator Thatcher. Question. It looks like on the House side there was a number of entries into OLS kind of worrying about the bill, concerned from people, but it looks like it was before the amendment, and I'm wondering if the amendment addressed most of those concerns.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, that's exactly right. Stuart mentioned, the bar did have some initial concerns. Stuart spent some time working with, I believe, three different sections of the bar, and they no longer object to the bill.
Okay, thank you.
All right, other questions? All right, let me see if there is anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2349A. Not seeing anyone. Tim, let me just tell you, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'd like to talk to you not about the bill itself, but there is a relating clause. I have an issue that I'd like to just see whether it can be folded, and I don't even know if it will fit, but we will move this bill. I'll talk to you to see if it's going to work into it.
We can help.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so with that, we're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing that we have for today, House Bill 2908A.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2908A brings Oregon law into compliance with H.R. 4980, the Federal Preventing Sex Trafficking and Strengthening Families Act of 2015. This was passed by Congress and signed by the President in 2014, and it requires several things of the state, some of which can be done through rules, but some of them have to be done in statute, and that's what you have in 2908. It allows placement of a child with a fit and willing relative as a permanency plan. It clarifies that only wards 16 years of age or older may be placed in what's called another planned permanent living arrangement, which is a situation such as with a close family friend or appropriate neighbor. It requires substitute caregivers follow a reasonable and prudent parent standard and provides the courts with opportunities to verify the standard is met. It requires documentation that wards have received and understand kind of a bill of rights that they should have. You have the A2 amendments in front of you, which just make a few technical corrections. However, we're still waiting on the paperwork for that, so it's not ready to move today.
All right. Thank you. Megan, why don't you come on up? And while she's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2908A? Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. My name is Megan Hassan. I work with juvenile and family court programs with the Oregon Judicial Department, and I served as part of the work group that drafted House Bill 2908 with Ms. Newell. And I'm just going to go through the major changes that the bill makes, and Ms. Newell already explained some of those, so I'll make it brief. First of all, under Oregon law, currently a child can be placed in another planned permanent living arrangement, which is frequently used for kids who are in permanent foster care or independent living or residential care. Under current law, a child of any age can be placed in an APLA plan after return home and adoption, guardianship, placement with a fit and willing relative have been ruled out. Under the new federal law and under HB 2908, APLA is restricted to kids age 16 and older. So DHS and the courts will need to go through cases currently classified as APLA and designate new case plans for kids who are younger than 16. Secondly, HB 2908 addresses the new federal requirement that DHS train foster parents in the reasonable and prudent parent standard. And what this requires is training around the decision-making for kids in foster care to participate in extracurricular and other outside activities. DHS under 2908 is going to be required to report this activity to the court. The court and the CRB are going to have to make findings around whether or not that standard is being followed and the child is being allowed adequate opportunities for activities outside of the home, only in APLA cases. The third piece is around transition planning. Under the new federal law, The age for transition planning is moved up to age 14. So this is planning that happens with youth in foster care around finding a job, life skills, finding housing, higher education. And so HB 2908 incorporates this into Oregon law and requires the court to make findings at permanency hearings about whether or not this planning has been adequate. And then last, the bill addresses the new federal requirement that for case plans of youth age 14 and up, that they be provided with a document that contains their rights under state and federal law, that that document be explained to them by DHS, and that they acknowledge it with their signature. That information is supposed to now be placed in the case plan. I appreciate your time, and I'm available if you have any questions.
Thank you. Senator Gelser first.
Great. Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Thank you for bringing this bill. In another committee, we are working on a bill related to extracurricular activities for students in foster care.
Yes.
And we adjusted the language that is here to clarify that solely attending religious services does not meet that requirement of an extracurricular activity. Is that something that would be appropriate to make consistent here, or would the other bill envelop that?
I don't think the two are inconsistent with each other, and I think they both could stand alone, and it would be fine.
And then just follow up?
Yep.
And the reason that we did that in the other committee wasn't to prevent anybody from going to church or synagogue. The idea was simply the act of going to a religious service once a week isn't kind of that extracurricular activity. You would do that and something else. Would, if this stood alone for these kids, would that requirement also be there that they have a self-directed ongoing activity that connects them with other youth of their choosing?
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Gelser, I don't think that I think that the standard in this bill is fuzzy, and it's going to be determined on a case-by-case basis about what's appropriate based on the age of the child and the developmental needs of the child. So I don't think there's really a black and white answer under this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Chair, I do think, because I'm on that committee too, and I don't think they necessarily mess with each other. This is a standard, and I think both will stand alone without conflict the way I'm reading them. So
we're going to have China. She's going to check in with LC and just confirm if there's is an issue, conflict amendments, if necessary. So we'll cover it. Plus, we can't move the bill today since we don't have all the paperwork, so we'll have a little breathing room to make certain we got everything squared away. All right, any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, and I've already asked if anyone else wanted to testify. No one jumped up and said they did, so we'll close the public hearing on 2908A, and we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3014.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3014 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3014 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Burdick, we wanted to hold off on this vote since you were kind of in and out, and just make sure that you remember which one this was.
Yes, I do. And
she's,
okay.
She's in now, so it's okay.
I'm here.
Yeah, I know she's in now. I just want to make sure she remembers which one it was. Okay. So with that, any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm very concerned. I appreciate that the judge will make that decision, but when you're bringing a new child into your home, to have to worry about going to another court proceeding to protect the integrity of your family when the parental rights and that relationship has been severed doesn't make sense to me. If we are going to have adoption where you adopt someone, then that becomes a member of your family. There shouldn't be a third party out there that has rights that you have to go to court in that process of adoption. So I appreciate the intent of the bill, but I think this is just a little bit too far. Once those rights have been terminated and a child is being adopted into another home, even in that period prior to the finalization of adoption, that's when those relationships are being formed, and this undermines the rights of those adoptive parents, and I think that's problematic.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could, it is the discretion of the court at this point in time to look at it, and quite honestly, if it's a slightly older child, and obviously if the parental rights have been terminated, there's bad seeds there, but the relationship that child may have with the grandparents may be significant, and I think allowing the court to look at that and try to see if there's a way to keep the connection might be important for that child, just so there is continuity.
And I would just argue that the parents who love that child, that would be a parental decision. Parents want what's in the best interest of their child, and adoptive parents should have no fewer rights to make decisions about who their children visit with and associate with than biological parents. It creates a distinction that's there. When you give birth to a child, you don't have to go to a court and have a court determine who that child should have a relationship with. Surely, in going through a process and going through a home study, you're looking at the special needs of that child and you're talking with those parents. But I think we should trust the parents to make those decisions rather than push that to the courts after the rights have been terminated.
All right, other questions or comments? Shauna, you want to give us a clarification?
Sure. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I just want to point out that this applies only in the time period between jurisdiction and termination of parental rights. So this would include grandparents of another parent when those rights have already been terminated. Say mother's rights have been terminated and father has sole custody of the child, or aunt or whomever. And then if there is an additional proceeding, those grandparents of the parent who have already been terminated are still able to have contact with the child. So it can be a fairly complicated setup, but it's not necessarily going to be a lengthy period of time. And these rights end upon the end of the termination proceeding. Independence.
This is more.
They don't extend out further.
I was listening to the testimony, and I thought it was kind of a segue transitional. And once the termination orders are in, this would conclude?
Correct.
Would it be possible to get more information and clarification from the department about how that works and who we're talking about and when that would apply?
Okay, so let me tell you. Let me just ask it this way. I feel we have votes and we've put stuff on the record as to what the intent is, and so we have a motion here, and I'm ready to go ahead and call for the vote unless there's a lot of angst in not calling for the vote right now and putting it off. But I feel comfortable based on what I've heard as to what the intent of that of the bill is. So are people still comfortable?
Good.
I hear the concerns, but I see this as a potential for a transitionary period for the child.
Yep.
I think it's all going to depend on how it's implemented, but I think some of these, I know in my case, grandparent relations were just critical. And
I appreciate that. I just think parent relationships are critical, and if we're going to respect the institution of adoption and the validity of families that are built by adoption, we shouldn't be weakening the rights of adoptive parents. And I really think that this does that, even in that transitional period. There is a long period of time from the time the child is placed with you until the adoption is finalized. And in that period of time, the parental rights have been terminated, but the kid is floating, but they're now in your family. They have brothers and sisters. They have grandparents. They're building these lifelong relationships. The court is going to determine that this is their real family, their actual family, their 100% family. This bill says something different. This bill says this kid is not wholly part of your family. The court gets to direct your parenting decisions, and it's not the same as if you had given birth to the child. So my level of angst is significant because I do think that it undermines the integrity of adoptive families in the state of Oregon. I take it personally because I am an adoptive parent, but
I understand that. So I'm going to, do a little personal here. I'm adopted, and I guess hearing what I've heard, I don't know if it's something that an adoptee should be prohibited from having those opportunities, have those conversations in that relationship. It was sometime in my former, or say my latter years, for me to make the connection to my biological family. And it's been significant. It's been very positive. And at the same time, I also understand, you do have situations that are not good. and termination means usually it's not good. But I'm comfortable moving forward, so I'm going to go ahead and call for the vote and understand that you're objecting at this point.
Okay.
All right. Any other objections besides Senator Gilser? All right. If you'll note that, thank you very much. We do have enough for the bill passes. Senator Cruz, I'm going to have you carry the bill, please. And with that, we're going to close the work session on 3014. And as I stated previously, I'm going to check with judiciary staff regarding the relating clause on 2349A and see whether or not there's an issue that has come up on in a setup that's a statewide issue and whether it will fit in there or not, and if we have enough time to really work the issue. If not, we'll definitely work the bill as is. And my goal is also to bring out 2908 once we have the paperwork and we get that squared away. With that, we're going to be adjourned, and tomorrow we're up for 8:30, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
If I'm not mistaken.
Correct.